Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Each episode, I'm talking to performers from film, television, and theatre about one significant role in their career. It might not always be the role they're most famous for, but in each one, I'll be trying to find out about the preparation, the excitement, and the sense of nostalgia that goes with any key role in an actor's lifetime. There are only a few performances in the history of film and TV that burn themselves into your memory for their sheer virtuosity and ambition. But for me, Sir Derek Jacobi's critically acclaimed performance as the twitching, stammering emperor in I, Claudius is certainly one of them. It was wonderful to have the opportunity to talk to him about the experience during lockdown earlier this year.
Derek, thank you for doing this. It's such a pleasure to speak to you.
And you!
It's so great. How have you been?
Okay, I mean, surviving like all of us. Okay, we're getting the hell out on Friday. We're going.
Oh, great.
We're going to France till the end of September.
Lovely, lovely. Well, listen, thanks for doing it. I'll get straight on because I just wanted to, you know, the reason I wanted to talk to you. Obviously, you know, you've done so much, but Claudius is such a big role for you and for so many other people, actually. But I wanted to talk a little bit before Claudius, because you left Cambridge, you went to Birmingham, and then you went to the Old Vic, and that was about 11 years, I think, 8 or 10 years or something.
It was, yeah. I started in Birmingham. Actually, I started in Birmingham on September the 19th, 1960. So it'll be 60 years this year.
Wow.
On the 19th of September this year.
But can you remember your first experience on a film set? When did you first go onto a film set? Was it Man of Straw?
The first film set I was ever on was 1970, 71. Fred Zinnemann, The Day of the Jackal.
Oh, wow.
That was the first film I did, yes.
And was... Well,
that was because his daughter was an usherette at the Vic, and she rather liked me.
I'm sure there must have been another reason as well.
Well, I think she helped.
But what was that experience like, going onto a film, having had your basic sort of experience of acting from the theatre? What was that like for you?
It was very different, very different. We were on location in France, I remember. The two things I do remember about it was that on my first day of filming, the hotel was within walking distance from the set. And I started to walk, and a car drew up beside me and said, this is your car. I said, no, I can see that. I can walk. No, Mr. Zinnemann says, car. So we had a little bit, look, I can walk. Eventually, I had to get in the car. The other thing was that on the second day, that night, I went into the restaurant and I became ill in the night. And I'd obviously got food poisoning. The next day, they had booked a room in the hotel, in the hospital in Cannes, and they thought it was appendicitis. They were going to rip my appendix out. And thank goodness I was saved again, this time by the wife of the producer, who said, give him till lunchtime. And if he's no better by lunchtime, then operate. Well, by lunchtime, I was coming, I was a bit better.
Wow.
Filming, you know, it was another world.
But were you able to deal with things like the continuity changing? Were you able to deal with things like, you know, having to wait around so much? Things like that. The real difference between what we do in the theatre, which is so sort of, it's like rolling down a hill, isn't it? But television, stop and start, film, stop and start. Was that a real shock to you?
It was also because you're in somebody else's hands. On the theatre, it's you and the audience, and you're in charge. Anything to do with the camera, you're not in charge. Somebody else is making all those artistic and creative choices for you. I mean, you learn your lines, you think the thoughts, you feel the emotions, but somebody else is deciding what bits of that the public are going to see, what bits work, what bits don't. So you're really at the mercy of somebody else making decisions that you automatically make for yourself on stage.
And can that be frustrating for an actor who's been in theatre to be on television? Is that a frustrating process?
In a sense, it's frustrating, but they pay you more. It's compensation. I mean, the only rich actors I know are film actors. I don't know any really wealthy actors whose lives, like mine, have been mostly on stage. No. We make good livings, yeah, but the mega bucks are the film boys.
So the frustration is sort of assuaged by the dollar.
The paycheck, yes. Yes.
And let's go on to I, Claudius, because you'd worked with the director and the producer before. You'd done Man of Straw with them. You'd worked with Herbert Wise before, had you?
Yeah, yeah. I'd done a BBC Two television serial called Man of Straw on BBC Two in early 70s, yes.
So when they were considering for you, I, Claudius, was that, it was a no-brainer to them, or was there other people involved? Or?
Oh, yes, I was not the first choice by any means, because the piece was owned by an American company, curiously called London Films, but it was an American company. They obviously wanted an American. They wanted Charlton Heston. And the Brits said, no, no, no. So then the Brits suggested Ronnie Barker.
Wow.
My salvation, I suppose, came when, I think it was Martin Lismore said, why don't we have just one actor who ages through it, rather than a young Claudius and an old Claudius? Because the old Claudius would have most of the part, i.e. Ronnie Barker or Charlton Heston. But let's go for a younger actor whom we can age up. And that was what I'd done in Man of Straw. I'd started as a sort of teenager and aged to late 50s. This one, eventually, I had to go and have dinner in an Italian restaurant in Shepherd's Bush with the man who was running London Films, who didn't know me from a hole in the ground. And charm him. And I think that was the best performance I've ever given. because at the end of it, he said, okay, we'll go with him.
Okay.
It happened.
And in that dinner, is that sort of like an audition? Or is he asking you how you would approach it? Or
it was more an audition, yeah. I was being sized up. How I sounded, how I looked, you know, what I was saying, what I came across as, I think. And thank goodness it worked.
And before that dinner, was it something that you had read? Did you know the book?
I knew the books, yes. I, Claudius, and Claudius the God. I knew the books, yeah.
And was that just recreational reading, or did you prepare those that reading for that interview?
No, I'd already read them long before I knew it was going to happen. I read them when I was at university, and I loved them. And Jack Pullman wrote the series, and it wasn't easy because there's very, very little dialogue in the books. But the one good thing is that Claudius is telling the story. So Claudius is in every line of the book because it's his story.
Well, he's the narrator, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I presume that all the old Claudius top and tail of scenes that we have, and then you age at the end, I presume you would do that all in one, or did you do it chronologically, or did you do all the young stuff first?
No, we did it chronologically. There were 13 episodes. I remember it started to be broadcast when we were still on episode 8. So we had a lot more to go, and it went out, and the critics were a bit iffy. They weren't quite sure. And as it progressed, they changed and they said, yeah, this is good. This is okay.
So was that a bit like being in the theatre where you're performing and you get iffy reviews? Did that affect the company as you were performing?
No. I mean, I never read reviews. I didn't read them. I was told that they weren't wonderful. And then I was told they're getting better. And by the end, you know, they were raving. And but it was, you know, it was the days, sort of early days in White City. If you look very carefully at the show, you will do a scene in a certain location, and then you'll transfer to another location. But what you don't know is that it's the same location, but the potted plants have moved. It was that basic.
But how did you come to rehearse it? Did you rehearse it like a... Because they're... One of the things that I would suspect with the initial iffy reviews is it was quite revolutionary for a television piece. I mean, it feels like a middle ground between theatre and television, because they're big scenes, they're theatrical scenes, there's big speeches, but it's very much a camera piece, you know.
Yeah, absolutely that. We felt very much like a theatre company, very much so. And we were encouraged to kind of big in the performance. It wasn't kind of televisual in the sense that it was inside your head all the time. We were encouraged to perform it, you know. And in that sense, it was different. It was very different. And as you say, though, long scenes. We rehearsed for 10 days each episode in the rehearsal rooms at Acton. Then we would have 2 days in the studio when we would record the whole thing. Then we'd have a day off, and then we'd start the next episode.
So, whoa, back up a second. So you had... 10 days to rehearse an episode and only 2 days to shoot that episode.
Yeah, only 2 days. And each day finished at 10 o'clock. If it went over 10, not the actors, the technicians got extra money. So come 10 to 10 and you've got 3 scenes left to do. It was, you know.
Wow.
You were encouraged to go a bit faster.
And when you're rehearsing for that 2-day shoot, is Herbert, is he talking to you about your character? Is he giving you character notes? Is he being a theatre director and then spending time with the cameras and moving the cameras around and finding his best angles at the same time?
Yeah, very much theatre director. very much so. And then the last, I think it was the last 2 days of rehearsal, Jim, the cameraman, main cameraman, would come in, and he would rehearse with us. He did the camera for the last 2 days. So when we got into the studio, we all kind of knew where the camera was going to be at any one time.
And in that first episode, was the rehearsal different? Did you come to the rehearsal room with your character, or did you have time, as in a theatre piece, to sort of discover your character in the room, to go down some blind alleys or something, or did you have to arrive with it?
No, blind alleys were visited often, yes. I went down several. But a lot of it was to do with the look of the thing. It had a very specific look about it. The design, us, our costumes, and me particularly, when I played old Claudius, of course, it was 5.5 hours makeup job. There was a sweet moment, actually. There was a young boy who played Claudius as a kid, a little kid.
Yes, yeah.
And he came in, I think, about the second episode. And I'd already established Claudius and his tics and his with his head and his limping and all that. And this kid was acting beautifully. And Maggie Tysak was playing my mum, sitting next to me. And at one point, we were watching him rehearse, and she said, look at Ashley. And I said, yeah, he's great, isn't he? Great. But she said, look at him twitching. I said, yeah, that's fine. But she said, he's twitching the wrong way. And I've done that, and this kid was doing that.
Oh, wow. But nobody would know that.
Lovely moment. And so we said, Ashley, love, you're twitching the wrong way, love. Can you do it? And it was so confused. He started to hear it like all over the place.
Do I go left or right?
Yes, yes.
That is brilliant. And when you're working on his mannerisms, you know, his stammer and his twitching, did you know which letters you stammered at, or was it more about a feeling of how the rhythm of the line was, or did you just let it flow?
Well, really, I let it flow. I mean, the first few scripts I got, if I had to say the word please, they were printed in the script, P, 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 P. So we soon got rid of that. And the designer, Tim Harvey, had an assistant who had such a stammer as Claudius, and I used to back him up against the wall and say, talk to me, talk to me. And I copied him. And also, what I didn't realize at first was that he didn't have a stutter. He had a stammer. And there's a difference between a stutter and a stammer. A stutter, you repeat, but a stammer is, and I might be wanting to say mother.
Yes.
So it's very difficult to help a stammerer because you can't always guess what they're trying to say.
Yes, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And with the physicality and the twitch, was that something that you purely came out of your imagination and trying, or were you watching other people? I mean, you say about talking to this man, but with the physicality, did you arrive at that somewhere else, or was that just purely from your brain?
I think it evolved. I think it just, I remember putting a pebble in my sandal so that I remember what foot I was limping on. But that didn't last very long. And then I knew that. Yes. The stammer and the twitch. The difficulty was, and this is where Herbie was so useful, was that as he grew older, he got better. I mean, he stammered less, he twitched less, and we had to work out at what stage we were at, how much less we should be doing, And then we would go back and do an earlier bit maybe. And, you know, so we had to keep an eye on all those various physical idiosyncrasies.
I have to say, I think that's one of the beauties of having seen it recently is how you go from someone who's totally sort of outside of that world, unconfident, private, to somebody emerging with a confidence into that world and how it physically has an effect on him as well. It's a wonderful arc that. And I wanted to ask you about how you, over 13 episodes or whatever, how you mark that arc. Do you have all 13 scripts before you start?
No. This, again, was where someone like Herbie was so vital because he had that arc in his head all the time. We kind of only had bits of it at a time, you know. So we relied very much on him to remind us of what stage we were at, you know, because we had, there was lots of lines to learn, there were lots of moods to remember, there were, you know, with the cameras and everything, and we needed Herbie. We needed Herbie. He was the mastermind, yeah.
There's something very important, I think, just to talk about, because there is a sense in that show that it's an ensemble show. You're the lead, obviously. You're the character that we're all there. But I think there's a sense of how actors can help each other out, actually. And there's that sense of ensemble. I know it's a television piece, but it's a bit more, you know, like I said before, a hybrid. Is that just about casting that ensemble, or is it something that certain actors, certain leading actors, have to behave in a way that shows what an ensemble is?
I think you're right. I think it does, as they say, come from the top. If the lead actor is a bit of a diva and a bit of a self-lover, I think it's disaster. It's disaster because Hamlet can't perform. Hamlet can't be Hamlet without everybody else. And it was the same with Claudius. You've got a sonking great leading role, but totally dependent on all the other characters, on Sean and Maggie and Johnny Hurt and, you know, all of them.
Yeah, and handing that baton on to each other. And I think that's something that is wonderful in the show, that you see people just, it's like that game we play in rehearsal rooms sometimes of throwing a ball to each other. And you see that in your dialogue.
Yeah, and there was one scene I remember when it was late at night. We were getting towards 10 o'clock, you know, the wishing hour. And the makeup girls were totally busy. Johnny Hurt as Caligula had just eaten the fetus of his girlfriend. And they were so busily doing her makeup. I made John up. At about 10, they gave me some blood and I was smearing it all over his mouth.
Oh, that's brilliant. I've just been watching that scene as well. That's great.
Yes. Yeah, well, I made him up.
So when, just also that sense of when we're working as actors before we arrive at set, what we want to bring to the rehearsal room, you have to be brave sometimes, don't you, in order to show what you've been working on and how you are and stuff like that. What are you requiring from particularly your director in a rehearsal room or on a film set to give you the room to be creative?
What I needed was the freedom to give the performance that was in my brain and in my heart. But that required total trust in everybody else, and in particular, again, Herbie Wise, who knew the whole the whole spectrum of the piece. But also for them to trust me, and not to be, shall I say, not to be too picky. You know, don't inhibit the actor by saying, you know, it's those actors who say, oh no, my character wouldn't do that. And they immediately close off 10,000 avenues. Of course your character, in certain circumstances, would do anything. You know, you can't limit your character. All of us, I could, in the right circumstances, I could probably kill somebody. In the right circumstances, it would have to be incredibly extreme. But we're human beings. We're capable of anything. Mm-hmm. So, if you say my character wouldn't do that,
he would. I often think that thing of my character can always behave out of character.
Yes. Yes, absolutely that. Absolutely.
As we all do.
As we all do, yes. Makes life interesting.
And where does a character start for you? I know there's the stuff like the Beryl Reed stuff of like, if I need to get the shoes and stuff. Is it a mixture for you externally and internally? Are you, you know, you're reading the history of the time, I presume you're reading about Claudius, you've read the books. Is it just seeping in? Is everything sort of seeping in at once, or is the one thing that you always have a routine into character?
I think what for me is always the bedrock is the text, is what you've been given to say, what you've been given, and why you say it. Your job is also to determine where what you are saying comes from, head-wise, heart-wise, spleen-wise. So the text is all important. To make the text live, for me, is the most important. And to be true to that text. And it's certainly true in Shakespeare. You've got to believe every word you're saying, knowing that a lot of it will go over people's heads. You know, the actors studying the Shakespearean roles, it's difficult for them. They don't understand it when they first read it. They've got to learn what it means, learn to understand it. And then they've got to deliver it like spoken thought so that the audience can understand immediately what you're saying, because they can understand your attitude. I think the attitude is what is so important. The way you say it, it's terribly important, because the intonation, the attitude, tips them off as to what it means. Because a lot of the Shakespeare is involved. It is archaic. But if you say it in a certain way, and the dumpty dumpty dump, all that carry on, forget it, the iambic pentameter, out. It's got to sound like spoken thought. It's the way you speak perfectly naturally. And if that means you've got to make the poetry sound like prose, or the prose sound like poetry, so be it.
I mean, I think there's also that sense of I've got to know what I'm saying before I can find out how I'm saying it, but also the reasons behind why I'm saying it is the big one, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Yeah.
And when you're with other actors and you're in that scenes with them, do you like to discuss a scene with the other actors? Do you like to talk about your motivation? Do you like to analyze the script, or do you like to get it on its feet quickly? Or, you know, do you like to discover emotion?
I like to get it on its feet. Yes. There are a lot of actors, very good actors. It's easier to talk a performance. Do you know what I mean? It's easier to discuss a performance. Then you get up and try and do it, and it's a whole new world. So for me, the best way is to do it, get it wrong, make mistakes, embarrass people, embarrass yourself, but it put it on its feet early, rather than discuss it and then get up. You can't. The discussion is you can talk the performance. You've got to do the performance. You've got to do it. Yeah.
There's this point, isn't there, I think, where talking is a very understandable fear. It's a barrier that you're putting up before you get on.
Yes, it puts the evil moment off, doesn't it? Yeah.
And likewise, I've always felt that way. You keep your script in your hand, even though you know it for as long as possible.
Yes, it's self-protection, isn't it?
I'm not really doing it.
Yes, exactly. And we're all cowards in that sense. Yeah, but you've got to expose yourself, and that means you get it wrong. That means you're going to fall flat on your face sometimes.
And when you're creating, if there is times, and in my life it's been quite rare in this moment, but when you really clash with a director or a producer about your interpretation versus theirs, I mean, not just character interpretation, but sometimes it can be simply the clothes they want you to wear or something like that, or how they want you to stand or what. How do we negotiate that?
Oh, it's not easy. I think there are stages in actors' lives and actors' travels and journeys through their careers. I mean, I remember very early on when I was at the National in the 60s, when we started in 63, there were no names, no pack drill, a couple of directors who were monsters. And who thought that actors their creative juices could only flow if they were in a state of abject terror. And there were several directors like that who whipped a performance out of somebody and terrorized a performance out of you. A lot of young actors, myself included, went through that period. But the best directors are collaborators. The best directors are on the journey with you and also making discoveries with you, allowing you to surprise them rather than dictate to you, so that it's a journey you both go on. He has his ideas, and quite rightly, you need him. You need that support and that direction. But if he's a good director, I think he also allows you to do something, think of something that surprises him and delights him. And, oh, yes, I hadn't thought of that.
I think that's true. And I think that, you know, I've encountered, I mean, and again, very rarely, but, you know, directors who actually hate actors.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. We get in the way sometimes. Yeah.
And it's so hard to suddenly be realizing that you're on a film set where the director really doesn't like us.
No.
Okay, I'm here for the coffee on this one.
Yeah, necessary evils. That's what we are.
We'll be back with more chat after this.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, you're listening to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Now, back to this week's episode.
And I'm Claudius, because I have to ask this. You're all, even interiors, exteriors, it's all in the studio.
Yeah.
We're watching you on those sets. What are you seeing behind the camera? What's going on in front of you? When you're looking out on the auditorium or looking out on Rome, what are you seeing then?
I remember being in the Colosseum, and it was a bank of seats. And on the floor down there were crosses where each gladiator happened to be. The camera was on the floor down there. And we were being very grand and looking around, seeing absolutely fuck all. And everything was happening down there.
That is brilliant.
We had to use our imagination, I'm afraid, yes.
That's great, because it must be very different then for you to be on, like, the set of Gladiator or something.
Yes, when it was almost the real thing, yes. Yeah. Extraordinary. Real tigers, doped up to the eyeballs, but real.
Yeah, they're all there. So your imagination is being asked to work less, I guess.
Yes, it does. It does. And I remember we sat there. The three of us who were playing senators, we sat there for days watching these gladiators and animals. And every time the camera passed, the three of us, we'd have to work out before the camera passes what face we were going to put on that day, because we'd run through all our expression. Yes. None left.
That's fantastic. That brings me to one of the things I wanted to ask you, though. It's in television. We do have to hang around a lot. There's a lot of film and television. There's, you know, you're not. There's a lot of other stuff going on, props and lighting and stuff like that. How do you keep yourself ready for the moment that you need to go on, particularly on a long shoot? I mean, how long was I, Claudius? How long did that take to shoot?
6 months.
Yeah. So how do you keep your energy? How do you keep your both emotionally and physically?
Well, I think there was a lot of work to do. There was a lot of lines to learn. There was, mm-hmm. as I say, the makeup took forever, costume changes. There was always something. There were very few moments of boredom. I would never know. Never important. But, you know, they say when you're making films and things that you're paid to sit around. The acting's free.
Yeah, it's true. Because you're hanging around so much. I mean, for me, though, sometimes my energy can drop and I can slightly get myself into a place where I think, oh, do I need to be here today? What's going on? And I think I have to keep reminding myself of why I'm there and what my job is and, you know, where my moment is, you know.
Yeah, I think that is vital. Those hours of sitting in a Winnebago, waiting to be called, and, you know, and yeah, it can be very tedious. But as you say, part of our job is to be ready when called.
Mm, yeah.
You know.
Which might be days after we were originally called.
It would be days, yes.
And tell me about, because obviously with Claudius, it's a big makeup job. You've mentioned 5 hours makeup. How Do you have input into that, or do you just wait and see what the makeup artist is coming up? Do you?
Well, when we started, they did. I had it was horrid actually. I was encased in plaster of Paris. It was a bit scary actually, with straws up my nose, which was my only contact with the outside world. The makeup girl, while the man was doing it, the makeup girl was holding my hand because I was being buried alive with this thing. And as it set, it got heavy and hot, and then they crack it open and they take it off. And she builds up the makeup from that model. And you know, we're talking of 76. It's 44 years ago, and the prosthetics were a bit rudimentary, you know, and they took a long time to put on. They all went on in little pieces, and then they had to be melded together. And it was full face, and I couldn't. I had to have soup through a straw for lunch, because I couldn't chew, because it would all break. And in the course of the day, she would rush at me all day with spirit gum. I grew to hate spirit gum, the smell and the feel of it, because it was in every orifice. Excuse me, that's the phone. No. It was all over the place. But no, I used to actually give myself to her, let her get on with it. She knew much more about it all than I did. Well, the extraordinary thing was when I first put the old makeup on and we looked in the mirror, and I looked like our author. I looked like him. Yeah.
And she hadn't designed it like that.
It was pure happenstance. But I look like him. I really did.
Was that at the end of the filming process? Was all the old Claudius done at the end of the process?
No, it was done every time. And in the 2 days, if I had to do old Claudius, we did that always on the second day. Because if we did it on the first day, and I took it off, I was often very spotty when it came off, you know, rash and whatever, and they couldn't film me. So we had to do old Claudius every second day.
Having just watched it, Derek, I am absolutely amazed that it was 2 days, that you did all that, one episode, plus the old Claudius in 2 days. I mean, that is extraordinary.
Yeah, we rehearsed 10 in the studio, 2, one day off, which was learning the next episode. Yeah.
Right. So in the day that you had off, you're learning
the whole... the next episode, yeah.
And when would you have got that episode? Would it be a couple of weeks before?
It varied. It could be just a few days before. And also, when you were concentrating on the episode in question, it was quite difficult to fast forward to the next. I mean, you read it, you knew what the sequence was, but to actually hone in on it and think about it, you were still thinking about the one you were doing.
And do you think then that the experience that you and the other actors would have had from weekly rep or whatever however you started in the business, that was helpful for going into that process?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I never did weekly. Birmingham was my first job, poor weekly. Even so, you know, you got through a lot of plays over the course of three years.
And that sort of dexterity that you're finding in that process is helping you in something like I, Claudius.
Yes, because it helped in actually learning the words, kind of verbatim. Then just thinking about the meaning, the intonation, why you're saying it, or the other, the depth of what is going on. Yes, but the actual learning came quite easy. And I've always, not quite so much now because I'm so old, but I've always been a fast learner. It helped me, and I read history at university. It helped me enormously. Just learning facts was the easy piece.
I mean, it is something that you need to keep in practice, isn't it? I mean, it just is something. I mean, the more you do it, it is a muscle, so it's that thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And in the theatre, obviously, when you're performing, there's the audience is there. They're slightly your guide. You can feel it. Who's your guide when you're on TV? Who is it? Simply yourself, or is it the director himself, or do you have?
Well, in I Claudius, it was mainly Herbie, the director, and Jim, the cameraman. He was great because he would. Jim would actually give you notes. He'd just come up and say, when you say that, when you love that, don't do this. Look over there. And little tiny things, which were very useful.
So they were technical camera notes rather than emotional notes?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they weren't character notes, but they were notes that made your character choices valid. You know, because you may have made a lovely character moment, but you were looking in the wrong direction for camera work. So he would tell you.
And do you ever watch yourself? Did you watch the monitor, or did you just trust? Never. You're putting two fingers up to me now. crossing your fingers.
Yes. No. I can't. I can't watch myself. I mean, There are lots of actors who can watch themselves and be totally objective and say, well, I mustn't do that again. I don't like that. I'm totally subjective. I just hate the way I look, sound. No. So why? I mean, acting is difficult enough. Why put yourself through that if you don't have to?
So you don't want anything between you and the inhabiting of the character that's external?
I don't want to be aware of that as a spectator. I don't want to be a spectator at the same time as being a performer. I can't. I mean, it inhibits me. It inhibits me if I see myself. Photographs.
Yes, I have a bit of that. Well, particularly as I get older.
John McLean.
But you said about... very luckily on I, Claudius, you were telling that story in a chronological way. How do you deal when you're filming and the chronology is all over the place? Do you keep a... Is the script your Bible, or do you keep a book outside of that? Do you keep notes on a script, or do you just trust the continuity lady?
Yeah. Yes, it's a short answer. I take it as it comes, actually. I'm a bit lazy in that sense, I have to admit. I don't write the arc. I rely on my instinct, the director and the continuity girl and all those people whose job it is to keep me in, to help me keep myself in the right place. No.
That's great, because I think that's some. It is there is somebody there whose job it is to do.
It is, yes, yeah.
Because sometimes I find that actors, when a continuity lady, and it, I'm saying lady because it, in my experience it always has been, but when they go over to an actor and say, "Oh, it was your right hand," or "You came in a bit faster in the scene. We did too much." Some actors take that as a bit of a like an insult or a sort of, and I don't know. I've never known why.
I don't know why. I mean, it's an essential part of a job. You know, without you, you're messing it up. You know, Yeah, we're all part of a team. This is the marvelous thing about our business. We all depend on each other. Nobody is good enough, big enough to do it themselves, to be on their own. You need everybody else. And that's what's so wonderful.
It is. Also, just with Claudius, obviously your physicality is quite violent at times. Did that take its toll on you? Did you, you know, did you feel, at the end of the day, did you feel physically, you must have felt physically tired and your neck must have been all over the place?
It was tiring, and I did early on rick my neck badly. It was a very early scene when I had to visit the Sybil. And I, you know, I said to her, well, what do I do when I talk to a Sybil? And she said, well, why don't you raise your arms in salutation and bow your head? And which I did, I bowed my head. He said, now twitch. And I twitched and put my neck out.
Oh, yes.
So I was in a neck brace. The neck breaks off and I twitched and I go, oh, it was so painful. Back on with a neck brace for several days.
One of the things I'd forgotten about watching it again is its humour and how funny it is.
Yes, yes.
The scene when you get married and you both stand up.
And she's enormous.
And Sean says she just kept going.
She kept going, yes. Yes, no, it was full of humour. I remember Sean had a line where she's busily slaughtering one of the youngsters. She goes to visit this dying boy. He says, thank you, Grandma, and thank you for being so good to me. And her exit line through the door was, goodness has nothing to do with it, which is the title of Mae West's autobiography.
Wow, that is fantastic.
Yes.
My other favourite one is after she goes to visit Germanicus and she's leaving and Tiberius is there and she says, as she's leaving, she says, don't touch the figs.
Yes! Yes! Yeah, it was full of those wonderful little moments. Wonderful.
But did that make it hard? I mean, in a two-day shoot, were there times... I mean, if anyone goes and stops corpsing, I mean, that must... The pressure must be terrible.
It did happen. I remember one of my... which I had watched. I watched it. I just a special screening of Bits at BAFTA. This was many years ago. It was Brian Blessed's death. Just brilliant. I mean, the camera goes in slowly, Brian on the bed. Sean is walking behind him, doing all the talking. And this man is dying. And the camera comes in. And Brian dies. He actually dies. Got to the end of the scene. And they had to retake it. And he had to do it again. And he did it again. And he died again. I've never seen an actor die like that.
But also that is a brilliantly brave directorial choice because Sean has all the dialogue.
Yes.
And she's talking and talking and talking and it just stays on Brian.
Yes.
Until she closes his eyes.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to her and she's weeping. And it's the first time we've seen her really emotional in that way.
It's a wonderful scene. Wonderful yeah. scene. Love it.
It's full of wonderful scenes, though, I have to say. I mean, just watching it again, it's just full of it. It's just brilliant. It really is. And because it is that hybrid between theatre and television, the actors are able to deal with it in such a brilliant way. And you feel totally at home with it. And of course, the sets, you know what it is. It would be made very differently now, but it's so brilliantly performed, I think.
We were allowed to be a theatre company in front of cameras. We really were.
But you didn't get to get your curtain call at the end.
No. And I got my comeuppance at the end because they BBC gave a luncheon for all the emperors. This was when we finished. All the emperors and the empresses were all invited to lunch at the BBC. We came into this room with the table all set out, and Johnny Hurt suddenly said, Derek, I think this is you. I said, okay. And I went over, and my place name said David Jacoby. They didn't know me effing name.
Were you straight on the phone to your agent?
And also, and the other thing was, because Sian and Johnny Hurt and everybody, they were stars. They were known people, and they were paid more than me. Okay, fine. When it all ended, I got a cheque from the BBC for £600 for my conduct at rehearsals.
Wow.
An extra £600 for my conduct at rehearsals.
That is, if only they did that now.
Talking 45 years ago. Yeah.
We don't even get rehearsals anymore. Which brings me actually straight up, because the other thing we wanted to talk about just briefly is Last Tango in Halifax, which is just fantastic. Obviously, Sally Wainwright, great writing. But I've heard you say that what's great about Alan for you, even though you are a working class boy, you don't get asked to play those roles.
I don't, no. I get costume, classical, Shakespeare, posh. I'm an East End lad, you know. But I'm never cast ordinarily. I suppose in the course of my career, I've done a couple of parts where I was rough. I once had to kick Tom Courtney in the face as a hooligan on stage. But no. So when Alan in Tango came along, I blessed the casting lady because I've always been lucky as an actor. I've had so many opportunities, a huge amount of luck. And there it was, still happening, still being lucky.
Well, your autobiography is called As Luck Would Have It, isn't it?
That's right, yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
And well, we all are lucky in a way, but also I must say that, you know, that the talent that we have to bring and the hard work that we have to have that luck. We have to acknowledge our luck, and I totally do that myself. But I think looking at your career, the building blocks are there, and your hard work and your work ethic is there as well. You know, so we create our own luck to an extent as well, don't we?
Yes, to an extent, yeah. I mean, we need a modicum of talent, yes. We certainly need health and stamina, but we do need the luck in the sense of being given the opportunity to strut whatever stuff we've got to strut. And it's those opportunities that is sometimes based on being in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. Luck, you know, it does happen.
And I think it's important to acknowledge that luck and just say, you know, I'm blessed here. And that's where your gratitude lives, and totally need that, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's been wonderful talking to you. I've been a fan of your work, you know, all my life, really. But I mean, you know, since I've been watching you anyway, which is not. But I mean, just stunning stuff. And watching I, Claudius again, honestly, it was such a pleasure, and it's so great to see you, but all of the actors, and what great work it was.
You know, I never saw Claudius for 10 years, and I happened to be staying with a friend in Santa Barbara in California, and she almost literally locked me in a room one weekend and made me watch all the episodes. It was rather good. I rather enjoyed it.
It was fantastic. Thank you very much, Derek. It's been wonderful speaking
Great
to you.
Great pleasure, David. Thank you.
Who Am I This Time? Is a Just Voices and Doolally production. Produced by Simon Lennigan. Music by Greg Hatlow. Edited and mixed by Russ Keffert at Audio Egg. And presented by me, David Morrissey.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.